Would you care to make a statement as to what occurred?
Well, I remember I was asking her about the ballet. Then I asked her if she liked this guy, Gord. She said something about just as a friend. Then I guess I hit her right then on the head. She was bleeding from the head, and the next thing I remember, it all happened so fast. She was on the floor, and I was sitting on top of her, choking her. I thought she was dead. There was blood everywhere. I just don't know what happened. I did it. I know I did it. I just couldn't stop hitting her.
On March 1st, 1974, Wayne Raby, a 20-year-old geology student at Arundale College, University of Toronto, was talking calmly to a fellow student whom, for the purposes of narration, we shall call Marilyn Lambert. They were in a hallway of the college near the gym. Suddenly, he took a piece of rock from his pocket, struck her several times on the head, and began to choke her when she fell to the floor. After a few moments, he stopped and made his way to the nurse's office, where he was subsequently arrested. The case ended up raising absolutely fundamental questions of legal responsibility. My name is Edward Greenspan, and what you are about to hear is reconstructed from transcripts in the County Court of Ontario and the judgments in the Ontario Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada.
The Scales of Justice, a series recreating real events in Canadian crime, with commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In our final episode for this season, you will hear Stephen Wimette as Wayne Raby and Lenore Zann as Marilyn in the true story of Beyond Control, written by Michael Tate and produced by George Jonas.
Miss Lambert recovered quickly and suffered no long-term effects. Raby, however, was arraigned on two charges: having in his possession a weapon for the purpose of committing an offense and causing bodily harm with intent to wound. The trial was conducted by Her Honor Judge Sidney Diamond, sitting without a jury, with John Greenwood as Crown Prosecutor and Michael Wadsworth acting for the defense. The Crown called Marilyn Lambert, who was sworn, and took the stand.
Now, Miss Lambert, what courses were you taking at the university?
Mainly the earth sciences, geology.
And could you tell us how you knew the accused? I mean, first of all, did he take any classes with you?
Oh, yes, he was in my classes. Oh,
would you speak up, please, so that everyone can hear you? Now, did you know him during this period socially?
Yes, he was one of the other people I knew fairly well.
Will you tell us the amount of social contact that you had with the accused?
Well, it was mainly just because we were in the same class. We would spend our spares together, he and I and two other fellows.
Well, would you tell us their names?
John and Rick.
Okay, now did you ever go on any sporting weekends or journeys together?
Oh, yeah. John and Wayne and I went on a skiing week to Mount St. Anne.
Oh, when was that?
That was during the Christmas holidays of that December.
Can you tell me if the association became any more intimate than you've indicated so far?
No.
Did you ever give him any indication that the association was any closer than one of friendship?
Oh, no, I tried to keep it just like that.
I'm showing you two pages written on notebook paper. Is this your letter?
Yes, it is.
Do you recall its contents?
Not really.
Well, I want to be clear about one thing. Did you ever give this letter to Mr. Raby?
No, I didn't.
Have you any idea how the letter, if it did, got into his possession?
Well, a bunch of us went to the pub that day, and I left my books on the chair when I went to the washroom. He could have taken it then.
What Marilyn Lambert had written in this letter was to prove a crucial factor in the case against Raby. But at this point, the prosecutor changed his line of questioning.
Now, I understand that on March the 1st, at about 12:15 p.m., you were on your way to your locker. Is that right?
Yes.
And at that time, you encountered Mr. Raby.
Yes.
And did you have some conversation with him?
Yes, I did.
To the best of your recollection, what was the content of that conversation?
I just asked him if he was going to class, and he said that it was finished for the day.
And what did he suggest you do?
That we go and watch some people play squash.
And did you?
Yes, we went to the observation gallery, but there was nobody in the court.
What happened then?
We went back through the same doors and down the staircase.
From your observations, how did Mr. Raby appear to you emotionally at that stage?
Just his normal self.
And then?
Well, we got almost down to the bottom of the stairs, and just then I heard this strange sound in the distance, like the roof was caving in or something. Hey, what's that noise?
Well, I don't know.
Listen, it's weird.
I want to ask you something, Marilyn.
What?
What do you think of Gord?
He's okay, I guess.
Well, how do you feel about him?
He's just a friend.
What do you think of me?
There it is again.
So, what do you think?
Well, you're a friend too, Wayne.
That's it?
Well, yeah, sure.
Okay. Fine.
Oh, don't! Don't! Stop it!
You bet! Did you attempt to defend yourself?
I couldn't the way he had me grabbed. He had me around the arm, so there was nothing I could do.
I understand you had three separate wounds on your head, requiring some 20 stitches to close them.
Yes.
And you had some bruising around your throat and on your face.
Oh, I never even looked at my face. I was too afraid to.
Thank you, Miss Lambert.
Cross-examination, Mr. Wadsworth?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. What I want to deal with is the matter of the relationship between you and Wayne Raby. Now, it was quite obvious that he had strong feelings for you. Is that correct?
I don't know what you mean by strong feelings.
Oh, Miss Lambert, you are a young woman, now 22. I'm sure every young man and woman is aware of what feelings the opposite sex may have towards them.
I wouldn't say it was obvious. I gathered that he felt that way, but I tried to avoid it whenever he started to talk or look in any certain way, so it never came out in the open.
Well, is it not true that on a number of occasions you and Wayne had taken walks by the Credit River and walked hand in hand?
Not hand in hand.
Never?
No.
Well, isn't it also true that on more than one occasion when you were walking by the river that Wayne Raby leaned over and gave you a kiss and told you he had wanted to do that for a long time?
Yes, that's true.
So you admit that he kissed you, but never even held his hand?
No, because I didn't feel the same way.
And then on another occasion, the two of you were together and you saw an advertisement for a ski trip to Mount St. Anne?
Right.
And the three of you, again, without alleging any immorality at all, shared the same room.
That's right.
Now, wouldn't it be fair to say that Wayne Raby didn't appear to have the same familiarity or sophistication that a lot of other students of the same age at Arendelle might have with a young woman?
I really don't know. I don't know what he did.
No, he certainly wasn't the kind of young man that you had to be really concerned about because he forced himself upon you sexually.
Oh, he was always proper, yes.
He was always
proper.
And suffice it to say, the two of you never had sexual intercourse.
Oh, no.
Those are all my questions. Thank you.
The Crown then called Kenneth Turner, another Arendelle student who had witnessed the incident. He was shown a photograph of the area taken shortly after the event.
There appears to be a blood pool at that point and a smear of blood running along the floor.
Yes, sir.
Now, what next did you observe?
Well, I continued down the flight of steps and he noticed me coming down and started up towards me. He looked very pale and started...
There's been an accident. Mm-hmm. A terrible accident.
Oh, yeah, it's okay, buddy.
It's terrible.
Take it easy. Everything's okay.
You see her down there?
Yeah, I see her. Maybe we better get some help. What do you say?
I killed her. I'm going to kill you, too.
Hey,
cool it.
Hey, cool it, all right? Let's go, damn it.
At that point, he tried to get me in a headlock and pull me down the stairs. My coat was undone, so I just let him pull it over my head, and my glasses fell off and my books dropped. Then I started to go for help.
Thank you.
The focus of argument now became the exact state of Raby's consciousness during the attack. The defense counsel faced a dilemma. If he acknowledged that Raby was rational when the attack took place, he would likely be found guilty as charged. On the other hand, if he argued that his client was legally insane, that is, at the time of the commission of the offense, he did not appreciate the nature and the quality of his act, the verdict might be not guilty by reason of insanity. But the consequences would be indefinite detention in a psychiatric institution. So dire an alternative that insanity is generally used only as a defense to a charge of murder. The defense's strategy was to enter a plea of not guilty based on a condition known as non-insane automatism, a rare but not unprecedented line of defense in Canada. Mr. Justice Ritchie of the Supreme Court quoted a definition given by Mr. Justice LeCursier in the case of Regina versus Kay.
Automatism is a term used to describe unconscious, involuntary behavior. The state of a person who, though capable of action, is not conscious of what he is doing. It means an unconscious, involuntary act where the mind does not go with what is being done.
In his cross-examination of Kenneth Turner and other witnesses, the defense lawyer sought to establish that at the time of the incident, Raby exhibited symptoms consistent with this condition.
Mr. Turner, in the matter of the accused appearance, I think you indicated that he looked very pale, was sweating and glassy-eyed. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So the impression that you had was a real weakness.
Yes, sir. Sick pale, sort of.
Now, let me ask you this. Have you ever seen anybody in a state of extreme anger?
I can't remember seeing anybody who was terribly angry.
Well, do you feel confident that you would be able to recognize a person in such a state?
I would think so, yes.
But I suggest to you that when you first saw the accused, this isn't what registered with you, was it?
No. He didn't appear to me to be angry.
Can you describe how he looked?
He looked scared.
Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Mr. Greenwood, re-examination?
Just one or two more questions, Mr. Turner. When the accused said there'd been a terrible accident, did you have any trouble understanding him? Was he coherent in the sense that you knew what he was saying?
I could understand him fine.
And when he said, quote, I've killed her and I'm going to kill you too, unquote, did his emotions change when he said that?
Well, he said it with force. He tried to jump me.
Any fear that you could see?
Well, I couldn't see.
At that point, was there any change in his appearance, his attitude, that you could observe?
Yes, there was a change, that's for sure.
How would you interpret that change?
Well, from a person who looked scared to a person who was a real aggressor.
Any more questions, Mr. Greenwood?
No, Your Honor.
Mrs. Vivian DeGeetis, the nurse at Arundale College, then gave her testimony.
Sometime after noon, the accused came into your office. Is that correct?
Yes.
I want you to tell us what he first said to you.
Well, I looked from my desk, and there was this young student standing there.
You've got to help me. You've got to come. I've killed somebody.
No, you haven't. Don't be silly.
Oh. Telephone her mother and say I've done it.
Right here with blood all over the place.
Get the police.
All right. I'm coming. Go in here.
What?
In here, quick. Now, stay there. Don't go anywhere.
Oh.
Now, when you say he was terribly upset, I want you to tell us his emotional condition from your observation and training.
He was filled with fear and anxiety.
Yeah?
He was, what's the word? Well, he was in pain.
Would you explain that?
Well, not physically. He was kind of in agony, almost as though he had been wounded.
Perhaps we can be specific here, Mrs. DeGeetis. Can you describe his facial expression?
Initially, when he came in, his face was blank, but his eyes were very intense, like his face was mask-like. I put him very quickly in the room, but when I came back, his face was contorted.
How was his tone of voice? Can you tell us whether he spoke normally, loud, or soft?
Well, he wasn't yelling, and he wasn't whispering. I would say it was a conversational level.
Can you describe any one respect in which his voice was not normal?
Well, I heard, this is only my opinion, I heard anguish in his voice.
Putting it simply, he was upset.
Well, the sound was upset, but the sight wasn't. I mean, he didn't look agitated, but he sounded like he was.
Thank you. That's all.
Mr. Wadsworth,
Apart from the expression on his face, Mrs. DeGutis, what about his overall appearance? The way his arms hung, his general appearance.
Well, he kind of hung from his shoulders, you know, how clothes hang on a hanger.
Kind of limp and rubbery?
Yes. I don't know whether you'd call it rubbery.
Ape-like?
No. He was straight, but no muscle tone. His hands were turned toward me.
Now, did you do anything when he first presented himself at your medical center?
I took his hand, checked his pulse.
Mm-hmm. What was there about his pulse?
It was thready, and it was very, very fast.
What does thready mean?
Well, not very strong. The volume wasn't good. Well, it was thready.
I take it there was some cause for concern.
Well, you don't want to have people with thready pulses running all over the place. You would like to stabilize them.
Do you recall during your contact with Mr. Raby that day whether he continued to suggest that he had killed Miss Lambert?
Oh, yes. He had telephoned his mother, and he was saying that to her when I happened to walk in. And I said, no, she's alive, but he didn't believe me.
Might it be fair to say that it didn't seem to register with him?
I don't know what he heard from me. I know what I said to him. I just said, the girl is not dead. And then I asked him if he wanted to speak to his mother again. Well, he didn't reply to me because he was moaning all this time.
Well, how do you mean moaning?
Well, just moaning and groaning with a kind of a... I don't know. I'm not a very good actress.
Well, I think we understand. Thank you very much.
The Crown then briefly questioned Detective Price, who had taken the statement in which Raby had admitted the assault.
Was this statement free and voluntary?
Yes, sir.
Could I have exhibit number one? This is the letter that has been identified as written by Miss Lambert. I understand you obtained it from the accused while he was at the station.
It was found in his jacket pocket, yes, sir.
Thank you. Your witness?
Yes, now Detective Price. Was Wayne Raby cooperative with you at the time of his arrest?
Yes, sir.
And would answer any questions you put to him regarding the incident?
Yes, sir.
Now, the reason I asked you that was in a statement he says, I guess I hit her on the head, and then the next thing I remember she was lying on the floor, and then he ends by saying, I just don't know what happened. Were you content to let it remain at that?
Well, for some reason, he didn't want to go into details on how he did it. Perhaps he didn't want to say.
Or didn't know?
I'm sorry?
Or didn't know.
That he had done it?
No, exactly how it happened.
Well, from talking to him, I felt he knew exactly what he had done. Prior to when that statement was taken, Mr. Raby told us what happened and why.
Well, are you suggesting that the statement before the court is in conflict with something else he said that you aren't bringing forward?
No. That's his statement. He could say whatever he wished on.
Yes, I just want to be clear about this. There are no inconsistencies from your interview of Mr. Raby from what has been proffered before the court.
I would say that is correct.
Now, as late as 4 p.m. when he gave the statement, would there still be emotional upset?
Emotional upset? Well, he was crying when he related the incident, relived it, so to speak.
Hmm. Those are all my questions, Your Honor.
The Associate Dean of Arundale College, Dr. W.J. Huggett, also gave evidence. He had spoken to Raby shortly after the event, and the defense lawyer explored this.
Dr. Huggett, if my notes are correct, you described Mr. Raby as speaking in a confused way and that he appeared depressed and dazed.
Yes, that's right.
You indicated that he said to you that he didn't know why he started or why he stopped, and also that he liked this young girl better than anyone else he had ever met. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, if a person was making up something, telling a lie, feigning something, do you think you might be able to detect that?
He would have to have some amazing qualification, Your Honor, to be a seer of the truth.
Now, let me rephrase the question. Would it be fair to say that at the time you had no feeling that what was being said was just something that was being made up?
I believed it entirely. I certainly didn't think he was deceiving or misrepresenting the situation as he understood it.
Thank you, sir.
At this point, Wayne Raby was called to the stand in his own defense. Having established a normal, blameless personal history and unimpeachable character, Wadsworth questioned him on his feelings for Marilyn Lambert in the period prior to the attack.
Well, I liked her. I liked her quite a bit. Like, as time went on, I liked her more, and we were spending quite a bit of time together.
Had there been any fluctuation in the relationship from, say, September to December of 1973?
Well,
In September, there was no relationship at all. October, the beginning of November, I guess you could say it was at its peak. Then it went down, sort of.
Mm-hmm. What about the period from December through to the end of February, or March 1st of 1974? What had gone on in that period?
Well, things became quite a bit rougher, I guess, for everybody in geology at that time.
Oh, how was that?
I mean, the relationships. John, well, I think he was sort of fed up with the way she acted on occasion. Like, one day she would talk to you, and the next day she wouldn't.
John's mad at me again, Wayne. I can't imagine why.
What'd she do, John?
Oh, forget it.
You know, actually, you look very handsome with a big frown. Just like what's-his-name.
You might have called. Or is that too much effort?
I just didn't have the chance. Honestly, John, my brother asked
Your
me to help
brother,
him.
Your brother, shit!
I don't like that kind of language. You know I don't.
Oh, Christ.
Here today and gone tomorrow.
Did you stand him up? Well, did you?
You think it's your business?
Well, don't get mad at me. What have I done? I haven't done anything. Marilyn.
Is there anything else, Wayne, you can tell us about your relationship with Miss Lambert?
It would seem to have had its ups and downs, quite a few.
All right. Now, I'm showing you a letter which has been introduced into evidence. Do you recognize this letter?
Yeah.
Now, how was it that you came to see it?
Well, she had asked me to help her with some problems, so I went into the library with her. We were working on some problems, and I remember she got up and left.
Mm-hmm.
She was gone for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and I was flipping through her notebook to find some equations, and I came across a letter, and I started to read it.
And what did you feel at that time?
I was sort of interested, I guess you would say.
Mm-hmm. And then?
I folded it up and put it in my pocket.
Did you read the letter more fully that night in your own home?
Yeah.
And what was your reaction?
I was upset at the time. I guess I was angry, too.
Yes?
And hurt. I sort of realized what had been going on all the time, and I was upset about it.
And what about the next morning?
I woke up and went to school.
Did you come into possession of any rock specimens that morning?
Yeah, I took a sample of galena. I remember I wrapped it up in a paper toweling, and I stuck it in my jacket pocket.
Had you done this with other specimens before and then returned them?
Yes. I had a key to the cabinets that Professor Robain gave me near the beginning of the year.
And there never been any objection to your borrowing specimens in this way?
No. Because you could do anything you wanted with them in the lab, like smash them up if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. They didn't really object.
All right. Now, you heard Miss Lambert indicate that she saw you in the area of the... excuse me, of the area of the lockers at approximately 12 or 12:30.
Yeah.
Had there been any prearranged meeting between you and Miss Lambert?
No. I first seen her, like, she just came walking out, and just for about a second, not even that, I felt sort of strange. Well, I can't describe how I felt.
Can you describe it in any way at all?
Mostly in the chest. I don't know. It was as if I was tensing up. It was just a flash.
Do you recall during this period any conversation you had with Miss Lambert?
We talked about the ballet for a while, because she had gone to it the night before.
Tell me this. What was your opinion of her as a person?
I thought she was a good person. Fairly good.
Now, I take it you agree with the testimony of Miss Lambert insofar as it relates to how it was that you went to the observation area of the squash courts and saw no one playing.
Yeah.
Now, describe what happened after you left this area. Take your time.
Well, we had started to walk downstairs. I can't remember exactly what we were talking about. I ask her what she thinks about this friend of ours, and she says he's just a friend, and the next thing, I'm choking her, and her face is a funny color, and I see a lot of blood, and I stop. The next thing I remember, I'm on the bottom of the steps, and I guess it's Ken Turner coming down, and I think I ask him to go for help. I don't hear him say anything back, and I grab him, but he doesn't run away or anything. He is just gone. The next thing, I see this lady's face. I don't know. I don't have any idea who she is, up in the observation corridor. But I don't know how I know it's there, because I don't see anything in between. The next thing, I'm in the nurse's office, and I tell her I've killed somebody, and to call Marilyn's parents. And she puts me in this room and asks me to stay there. I sit there a long time, and sometime later, a police officer comes in, and he takes me to the station. They fingerprinted me and took my picture, and then two detectives took me to this room and read me some things about my rights. They asked me if I had anything to say, and I started talking, and they started typing. Then they gave me the piece of paper, and I signed it.
Now, the only matters I wish to ask you about now, Wayne, concern your medical record. Have you ever suffered from any form of physical illness other than the normal childhood diseases?
No.
And prior to March 1st, 1974, have you ever had occasion for any reason to seek the assistance of a psychiatrist?
No, I haven't.
All right. I think my friend will have some questions for you as well.
Now, Mr. Raby, I want to go over again your association with the girl in this case. You are an intelligent boy. It must have been obvious to you that her interest in you was not particularly great.
Yes.
And it would appear, am I putting it fairly to you, that you had some considerable difficulty in accepting that reality?
Possibly, yes.
Because you travel? You brood on it and become upset and worry about it?
I couldn't say.
Well, I want you to say. You're the only one who knows, and I want you to attempt to be very candid with me.
Well, usually I didn't think about it. I just sort of went along.
Uh-huh. But whenever you did think about it, would it be fair to say that you suppressed your concern and anxiety?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Well, I believe you put it to one of the psychiatrists who examined you in connection with this case that she was the only girl you ever loved, or words to that effect.
I don't think I ever used the word love.
Well, I'm reading here from a report by Dr. Rozelle, who is quoting what you said when you spoke to Mr. Huggett. Quote, I don't know why I started or why I stopped. I like her better than anyone I have ever known, unquote. Now, does that sentence strike you as fairly easy to understand?
Yes.
Well, was that an honest statement to Dean Huggett?
I don't remember saying it, so, like, I don't remember talking to him.
Mr. Raby, don't fence with me. Just tell me, if that was your honest emotion on March 1st of 1974.
It might have been, but I don't remember saying that, and at the time, I don't really remember feeling that way.
Did you like her better than anyone you have ever known on February 27th?
I don't think so. I had liked her before, but at that point, I didn't feel I liked her that much.
Well, let's go into that. After this strong emotional attachment in October and November of 1973, you appeared to have reached a point where you became disillusioned. Would that be putting it in a fair way?
I wouldn't say disillusioned. Possibly disillusioned, but I'd say it was more I'd become confused, sort of, about what was going on. I couldn't understand why one day she
would
talk...
We'll change it again, Mr.
Your Honor, the witness was completing an answer, explaining the matter.
I think, Mr. Greenwood, you cut him off.
Yes, Your Honor. All right. One day?
Well, I couldn't understand why one day she would be nice to me and I'd feel good about that, and then the next day she wouldn't talk to you. Quite often she would become mad at somebody else, and if I happened to be sitting with them, she wouldn't talk to me either.
Mr. Raby, it's a healthy emotion. Didn't that make you annoyed?
Possibly a bit.
Well, regardless of whether she talked to you or not, or had a beer with you, or did homework with you in the group, it was obvious she wanted nothing to do with you on a very personal basis. Wouldn't that be true?
I don't know if it was obvious.
Well, she didn't want to be your girlfriend. She didn't want to have sexual intercourse with you. And she played you like a yo-yo. I mean, would that be right?
Yes. But at the time, I really didn't think of it that way.
Very well. In any event, did you observe her in class writing a letter to a friend or writing something that was not being dictated or part of the lecture?
That would be the Thursday, yeah.
And, in effect, you
stole the letter?
Yes.
Did that bother you at all? No. Was it an unconscious act, Mr. Raby? No. Conscious, wasn't it?
Yes.
Well, when you took the letter, and I want you to look at the letter because I propose reading it, you didn't read it casually, did you? You read it with great detail, and you brooded over it.
Well, like, I took my time reading it, and then afterwards I just put it in my pocket, and I sort of put it out of my mind.
All right, well, we're not going to go through all of the letter, just those areas that you felt were important, because you marked them.
If you want.
Well, how did you feel when you marked these parts of the letter?
I was upset.
Very upset?
Yeah.
Very angry?
I don't know if I was angry. I was upset. I was disillusioned. I don't know if I was angry.
Mr. Raby, you were in a rage. Were you not?
No. I was up in my bedroom. I wasn't storming around the house or anything.
Maybe if my friend could distinguish between rage and anger, that might be of some assistance.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I'm not here to answer the questions. I'd like to get the witness to do that.
I think the witness has denied any feelings of either.
Very well. Then let's go into the letter and read those parts that you think were important. Now, your first marking, if you would read along with me, quote, on the bus to St. Anne. Did you see that?
Yes.
Okay. I worked my way... this is the girl talking here. I worked my way onto the bus that Dave Reed was on. He's the one I wanted to meet, and on the bus he said he wanted to go to bed with me.
I almost died.
Didn't
we? Well, in the end, he went to bed, but that was it, because I'm not on the pill, and he doesn't use a safe, but he's got one of the better diseases. Oh, my God, what hands! He's made a study of how to touch women where it's an art, and it certainly is an art. Well, next week I'm going to see about going on the pill. And any embarrassment will be worth it for the chance of really going at it with him.
Is this important to you?
Right now? No.
No, but at the time that you read it.
Oh, I put a mark there, so it must have been important. I guess I felt jealous at the time.
Very jealous.
I wasn't aware of feeling jealous.
It wasn't a moral position with you, Mr. Raby, because...
No.
You would have happily had intercourse with this girl yourself?
Yes.
So that it had to be that she thought more of someone other than you, much more.
But I wasn't thinking of that when I put the mark there.
You just marked it?
Yes.
For no reason?
It upset me.
Well, I wonder if I could put a normal emotion to you, Mr. Raby. If you think a great deal of somebody, and they don't think a great deal of you, and you find they are secretly seeing someone else, the emotion which a normal person feels is jealousy. Do you know that?
Yes.
You turn over two pages. This one appears to be extremely important because you've double marks beside it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Quote. Hell, I can insult Wayne, that's you, Wayne and Rick, and they still bug me in class. I want to be alone or just with one good guy,
just not one good guy, not with a bunch of nothings. Well, that sounds bad, but I'm sure you'll understand.
Did that bother you a great deal?
Yeah, it confused me a lot because just earlier, before in the day, maybe 4 or 5 hours before, we had gone to the pub together. And she had asked me for help on one of her assignments.
Okay, well, I'd like you to stay only with the letter. Now, from the letter, as I read it, it would be apparent to a four-toed sloth that she didn't like you. You bugged her. She didn't want anything to do with you.
Just from the letter, yes.
Now, let's get to the day that you struck her on the head, Mr. Raby. You picked up the rock, Galena, for some particular purpose. Why?
I was going to take it home and study it.
You will agree with me that it's quite a heavy stone?
Yes, it has a high density.
If you hit somebody on the head with it, it would do a lot of damage because of its density and the sharpness of the stone when it fractures.
It was in a crystal state, so it breaks very easily. If it was a massive piece of galena, it would do more damage.
And if it were a steel bar, I'm sure it would do more too, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Now, when you first saw the Lambert girl at her locker, you felt an emotion of some sort.
It was just a feeling for about a second.
And then you went over and you talked to her in an extremely friendly fashion and said, let's go and watch a game of squash.
Yes.
So I suppose you knew what you were talking about. You were playing a charade at that point because you didn't like her, did you?
I wasn't thinking about the letter at the time. I was just talking.
Do you recall asking her how she liked... I believe the boy's name was Gord.
Yes, that was right before it happened.
Do you recall screaming, you bitch, while you were strangling her?
No.
I'm going to stop at this point, Mr. Raby, because you've been there for some time. It was... an extremely vicious attack on a very innocent girl. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Well, has it caused you any concern with respect to your own mental condition?
Yes.
Well, have you a fear about this matter recurring? Does it terrify you?
I think it does, yes.
Just one final question. When you thought you had killed this girl, did you think you were insane?
At that point, I wasn't really thinking.
Yes, I have no further questions. Thank you.
This cross-examination was damaging on a number of counts. The image of Raby that the prosecution suggested was of a young man who, in a jealous rage, strikes a girl on the head with a piece of rock acquired for that purpose. To challenge that interpretation of events, the defense called Dr. Basil Orchard, an experienced forensic psychiatrist who had examined Wayne.
Could you tell me, Doctor, if the term dissociative state is a recognized term in psychiatry?
Yes, it's a clearly recognized diagnosis taught in all the medical schools and mentioned or described in detail in most textbooks in psychiatry.
Mm-hmm. I would ask you then if you would assist Her Honor, please, as to what your opinion is in the matter of Wayne Raby's state of mind on March 1st of 1974 when this occurrence took place.
Well, it is my opinion that this otherwise healthy young man entered into a complete dissociative state at the foot of some stairs after some conversation. The dissociative state that I see is a condition, but not a mental illness. It would be my further opinion that in that state, there would be no mind in his action, that he was unconscious. It's not a matter of forgetting afterwards something unpleasant like an hysterical amnesia, not like that.
Now, my question is this, Doctor. How is it that you exclude the danger of a person feigning such a memory lapse?
Well, in my practice, I've seen a great many people who feign all sorts of things. The dissociative state is not a common enough thing for people in general, the public, to have heard very much about it.
Hmm?
So I think it would be hard for him to so well describe the state without having somebody tell him that you're supposed to say this, that, and the other. Secondly, my whole examination of him didn't seem to indicate a person who would tend to lie.
Yes, I see. Now, Doctor, something that would appear to be as motiveless, as out of character as this, some people might say would occur only with a person who was psychotic, had the disease of the mind. Did you consider that in your diagnosis as being a possibility?
Yes, I did.
And could you assist Her Honor, please, as to why you excluded it from your consideration?
Well, there was no evidence of psychosis at the time of my examination, about 5 weeks after the event. He was logical and coherent. There was no evidence of thought disorder.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. In your opinion, is there a danger that what happened here will recur with Wayne Raby?
With all the medical certainty I can muster, I would say no. There is no danger that it will recur.
I must ask you what it was in your view that triggered the dissociative state of the accused.
I think he received an enormous psychological blow in the first instance because she said, like the boy Gord, he was just a friend, thereby relegating him to a category of people who, in the context of that remark, meant nothing to her, who were bugging her in class and so on. Also, he had a very high opinion of her and couldn't endure the evidence that she was going to bed with one person and then another. He couldn't tolerate seeing her in that way. I think that was the other part of the blow.
Mm-hmm. How does the dissociative state, which you have described, relate to the type of automatism that can be found when a person suffers a physical blow to the head or skull?
It's comparable, the only difference being that the blow is emotional rather than physical. You could have the same symptoms if you got hit over the head. But This is an emotional blow. Mm. It's non-insane automatism. It's non-recurrent and not related to any disease of the mind.
Thank you, Doctor.
Dr. Orchard's views were directly opposed by the psychiatrist who gave evidence for the Crown, the equally eminent Dr. Peter Rozelle.
I endeavored to reenact with Wayne the Thursday and Friday episodes. One thing appeared to my observation, of which Wayne seemed to be unaware, that when he was focusing his attention on his hurts at the hands of Marilyn, there was a tightening of his jaw. His breathing was quicker. There was an unmistakable angry look on his face, accompanied by what I described to myself as a glassy stare. What I saw was a sort of frozen anger during that period of my examination.
Dr. Rozelle, in your opinion, did the accused enter into a dissociative state prior to the injuries suffered by the Lambert girl?
No, in my opinion, he did not. My reason for saying this is that from my examination, he is a controlled boy who went into an extreme state of anger at that moment. He hit this girl on the head who had injured him so much and, in his rage, carried on with the choking.
In your opinion, was Wayne Raby at the time of this event, and is he at the present time, suffering from any psychiatric problem?
Yes, sir. In my opinion, he is. He's still in a state of mild depression, but in addition, he's blotted out from his awareness some of the things that went on at that period.
And when did the blotting out occur? During the event or after?
In my opinion, it was after the event. And there's reason for that loss of memory. The act is so utterly foreign to his concept of himself as a nonviolent person that if I, Wayne, did a thing like that, then I'm out of my mind. It's as if he has suppressed, to some extent, his awareness that he can be this violently angry, as indeed we all can. I'm very sympathetic to him, but I do insist that he has to be faced with himself.
Unless you have something further to add, I have no further questions.
No, I don't think so.
In his cross-examination, Wadsworth pressed Rozelle to admit there was a large body of orthodox psychiatric opinion which would support Orchard's diagnosis of non-insane automatism in the case of Wayne Raby. Rozelle replied that no doubt there was, but that in many respects he was in disagreement with it. He emphasized the matter was a continuing controversy among psychiatrists. At the conclusion of his final address to the court, the defense counsel fastened on this point.
I have little doubt that your Honor's task would be a great deal less onerous. Medical opinion could be honed to mathematical precision and certainty.
That certainly is not so in the field of psychiatry.
I can only suggest to you that the bizarre occurrence which unfolded before you became even more perplexing with the evidence of Wayne Raby and your opportunity to see and hear him. The evidence of his outstanding character and the maze of incongruity becomes understandable, I submit, only through the evidence of Dr. Orchard. However acceptable the opinion of Dr. Rozelle may be, in my submission, it cannot be a total refutation of the medical opinion of Dr. Orchard. Now, that being so, the prosecution cannot claim to have proven beyond any reasonable doubt the voluntariness and criminal responsibility of Wayne Raby for his actions. Accordingly, it is my respectful submission that the proper judgment with respect to this matter would be not guilty. Thank you, Your Honor.
In his turn, the Crown also drew attention to legal precedents. In particular, those cases where a psychological shock had been advanced as a defense.
The courts have distinguished between several types of automatism, or several types of dissociation, and the cases have indicated where there is no external cause, where it is psychological shock that brings about dissociation, then this can never be a defense that would allow acquittal. I submit, with respect, there are only two possible conclusions in this case. If Your Honor accepts the evidence of Dr. Orchard that there was a psychological blow and resulting automatism, the only conclusion available to you is that the accused is not guilty by reason of insanity. If you find there was not psychological automatism, if he was conscious of what he was doing, he would be guilty of the offense.
After a week's adjournment, during which she considered a large volume of formidably complex testimony, Judge Diamond gave her judgment. She quickly dismissed the first charge, possession of a weapon for the purpose of committing an offense, giving Raby the benefit of the doubt as to his motivation for taking the rock from the laboratory. She then turned to the main charge, that Raby had caused bodily harm to Marilyn Lambert.
I reject entirely the theory of planned revenge, not only for the reasons given with respect to Count One, but also because of my own assessment of Raby in the witness box. He was absolutely straightforward in giving his testimony, and I found no contradictions in anything he said which would lead me to disbelieve him. The issue of automatic behavior, of unconscious involuntary actions, has been raised squarely by the defense. I'm satisfied from the evidence given by Dr. Orchard, by the accused himself and the witnesses, Lambert, Turner, Huggett, and DeGeetis, that there was evidence before the court, and here I'm paraphrasing from Mr. Justice Kelly in Regina versus Spruill, upon which a jury properly instructed could have found that at the time of the wounding, Raby had been suffering from a malfunction of mind described as dissociation of the type brought about by an externally originating cause.
This finding of an external cause was of crucial importance. Case law in Canada holds that the defense of automatism is only valid if the automatic behavior is the result of such an external cause.
Such external cause would have been the words about Gord being a friend, which tied in with the knowledge of what the letter had said, constituted an external blow or trauma, which resulted in Raby's being in a dissociative state. I'm satisfied that Raby was not insane within the meaning of Section 16 of the Criminal Code when the acts were committed. And I am in a state of real doubt as to whether the accused acted in a state of automatism so that there was no mind behind the act. I must, consequently, give the benefit of the doubt to the accused that he acted in a state of automatism brought about by external cause. There will therefore also be an acquittal on the second count of the indictment.
The Crown appealed this verdict to the Court of Appeal of Ontario. Mr. Justice G.A. Martin upheld the Crown appeal, rejecting a central point in the previous judgment. The critical issue was whether the condition in which Raby was at the time of the offense was within the legal definition of insanity. This in turn depended on whether he had a disease of the mind, which is how insanity is defined in our law.
In my view, the ordinary stresses and disappointments of life, which are the common lot of mankind, do not constitute an external cause, constituting an explanation for a malfunctioning of the mind, which takes it out of the category of a disease of the mind. To hold otherwise would deprive the concept of an external factor of any real meaning. In my view, the emotional stress suffered by the respondent as a result of his disappointment with respect to Miss X cannot be said to be an external factor producing the automatism within the authorities. Therefore, I am of the opinion, with deference, that the learned trial judge erred in holding that the so-called psychological blow was an externally originating cause. A new trial must accordingly be had on count two.
But the defense in turn further appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. Here as well, the majority rejected the defense of automatism. Mr. Justice Ritchie wrote the majority judgment.
It seems to me that his infatuation with this young woman had created an abnormal condition in his mind, under the influence of which he acted unnaturally and violently to an imagined slight, to which a normal person would not have reacted in the same manner. For this reason, as well as for those expressed by Mr. Justice Martin in the Court of Appeal for Ontario, I would dismiss the appeal and dispose of the matter in the manner proposed by him.
However, this judgment prevailed only by the narrow margin of 4-3. Mr. Justice Dixon wrote a strong dissenting opinion.
There is no evidence to support Mr. Justice Martin's statement attributing the dissociated state to psychological or emotional makeup of the appellant. To exclude the defense of automatism, it lay upon the Crown to establish that the appellant suffered from a disease of the mind at the time of the attack. The existence of the mental disease must be demonstrated in evidence. Here, there is no such evidence from any of the expert or other witnesses with reference to the crucial period of the assault. The Court of Appeal's conclusion was directly contrary to the testimony of Dr. Orchard, accepted by the trial judge, and finds no support in the testimony of Dr. Rizal. I would allow the appeal.
The Supreme Court was sharply divided, not surprising in a case so complex. On the one hand, society has the right to protect itself against dangerous individuals, and Raby had shown himself vulnerable to a so-called psychological blow and to be dangerous when in the resulting dissociative state. On the other hand, is there any real distinction between a dissociative state which results from a psychological blow as opposed to a physical blow? Does the distinction which the courts draw really make sense? Or are the courts simply displaying a distrust of the kind of expert evidence presented in Raby's case? And more to the point, a fear that juries will be misled into acquitting the clever faker. As was said by a judge in one of the leading Commonwealth cases, blackout is one of the first refuges of a guilty conscience and a popular excuse. It is often an excuse, but it is also sometimes true. And there are no easy answers. Raby was obliged to stand trial a second time. In the lengthy intervening period, he had proved himself a model of sanity and reasonable behavior. He pleaded guilty to a charge of assault causing bodily harm and was given a conditional discharge with a probationary period of 3 years, a lenient sentence which perhaps reflected the sharp division of opinion in the Supreme Court of Canada as to whether he should have been found guilty of anything at all. Arguably, the case was well concluded in human terms, but it revealed great conflict in legal ones. Historically, the problem facing courts of law was well stated by Judge Hale of New England as far back as the 17th century.
It is very difficult to define the individual line that divides perfect and partial insanity. But it must rest upon circumstances duly to be weighed by the judge and the jury, lest on the one side there be a kind of inhumanity towards the defects of human nature, or on the other side, too great an indulgence given to great crimes.
You have heard the true story of Beyond Control, the final episode in this season's series of The Scales of Justice, recreating real events in Canadian crime. The script was by Michael Tate, and the commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In the cast, you have heard Stephen Wimmett as Wayne Raby and Lenore Zann as Marilyn. Crown Prosecutor F.J. Greenwood was played by David Calzarisi, and the defense counsel Michael Wadsworth by Michael Tate. You have also heard John Bethune, Alan Fawcett, David Ferry, Elva May Hoover, Eric House, Karen Kramer, William Lynn, Frank Perry, Kenneth Pogue, Henry Raymer, Desmond Scott, and Tony Van Bridge. Charmian King was heard as Judge Sidney Diamond. Technical operations were by Derek Stubbs, and sound effects by Stephanie McKenna. The production assistant was Nina Callahan. The music consultant was Stephanie McKenna, and the casting director, Ann Weldon Tate, with the assistance of Catherine Kester. The associate producer is Guy Gavriel Kay. The Scales of Justice is produced in Toronto by George Jonas. This is Fred Napoli speaking. And now, a final word from our host, Edward L. Greenspan.
With this episode, we bring to a close our third season of The Scales of Justice. I hope you have enjoyed our examination of real events in Canadian crime, and I am pleased to be able to tell you that we will be returning next year with a fourth season of The Scales of Justice.